Welcome back, everyone, to the Language and Behavior Podcast. I'm your co-host, Joshua Stamper, and I have the... What adjective do I want to use today for the fantastic, the wonderful, the brilliant Charlie Peck?
Wow. Wow. That is a little much, but thank you. Nice to see you.
I'm going to have to like have a list that I produce to just check off because I have to have something positive to say because you're a rock star, Charlie. You did just a phenomenal job this last week with your Thriving Educator webinar. Had the privilege and honor to be with you. And I just want to thank everyone that came out and were with us for that special event.
You know what is? It's so nice. We have so many people all across the globe showing up, and that just shows all the work that people are doing in our schools and organizations. It's not always just schools that show up. So there's a lot of organizations working with kids, youth, but people who want to develop their people, that human aspect of, you know, leveling up their work. So it's good stuff.
It is good stuff. And for those who may not have been able to make it, there's some good news. We've got another event coming up in May. Charlie, do you want to share a little bit about the webinar coming up?
Yeah. And so we're just going to showcase a little bit more about what Thriving Educator is doing to level up the school and district organizational, really, training that we're doing for education leaders. So it's not just for administrators, it's for school counselors and any of those rock star teacher leaders in the building who want school mental health to be improved. And that way that they can protect kind of their own well-being while responding more effectively to student behaviors. So that's coming up in May on May 27th, same time as the last one, 6:30 to 8:30. It is new information. That's Eastern time, by the way. It is new information, but we are showcasing what Thriving Educator Premium is doing.
Yeah, it's a wonderful event, but then also just information. I know a lot of people were very thankful for the resources that they received. And so because of that success, we're so excited to bring this to you again in May. So again, that's May 27th, and we'll make sure that we have the link available to you all as soon as possible. But currently we're building that out. So again, thank you for everyone that joined us this last week as we had our very first successful webinar. All right, Charlie. So looking at the questions, you know, we get questions all the time from various spots. And this one, I don't have a name that's associated with the question, but I think it's coming from what we talked about on the last episode. And so it is, how can restorative practices be used in schools and workplaces to correct misbehavior? And we did mention restorative practices, but we really didn't hunker down on that term or what that even means in schools.
Exactly. And that's it. I love when we link from one to the next because that means people are really invested in what we're talking about and want to just do better practice. So I will kind of give the lens of like the clinical lens of restorative practice and why I even use it with my kiddos that I work with in individual therapy and in group therapy sessions, I've used it as well. But it's rooted in like cognitive behavioral practice. There's reflection. There's kind of that self-monitoring. Skill building is always a part of it. But motivational interviewing is kind of a piece of this that I love because it gives people autonomy and it helps us to collaborate, but also take on the responsibility, which promotes that autonomy, which we need students to do desperately. And by the way, sometimes adults. So there's more there, like the trauma-informed practices there that creates safety, helps with promoting self-regulation and all of this too. What is your experience though, Josh? Because you've had so much practice with and training with restorative practice specifically.
Yeah, this was something that multiple districts that I was a part of sent us to training to get certified. But then also, I mean, there were conferences that were specific just on this topic alone. And the area that I was working in was with North Dallas, and the student behavior was increasing in every school that I was a part of. And for myself, I was looking for an alternative because, and we've talked about this before on this podcast, as far as the data, you know, ISS and OSS and even expulsion wasn't working, or an alternative setting, sending them to a place to then return. And we saw the same behaviors. And so for myself, I was just frustrated. And this was kind of a combo for me. I got the TBRI trust-based courses and training through that, but then I also got the restorative practices from the district. And so what that looked like for the restorative practices piece was the teach piece, the understanding that they are taking ownership of what's going on, getting the skills needed to be successful moving forward, but then also restoring the harm that was caused by the individual. And for me, going through the training, it was like, this seems like it should happen everywhere. Like, this is common sense. This isn't something grand. And I think unfortunately, over time, and this was maybe right after the pandemic, they were starting to get this like turned off of the word restorative in general. And this was from my campus, from the district, from even nationally, I saw on social media. But when you really get down to the bottom of what that looks like, it's, are you okay with teaching the children the correct way to behave? And everyone was like, well, yeah, well, that's what restorative practice is. So unfortunately, there was the term kind of bristles some folks because they think it's like kumbaya, everyone's in a circle, you're holding hands, singing songs together, and there's no consequences. And I just want everyone to understand that that's not the case. Like, there are consequences that the student receives. It may not look like your traditional punishment that you're used to, it maybe from when you were a child or early on in your teaching career. But the main thing is that, and we talked about this last episode, is that the consequence is related to the action of the student. So that way there is a learning component there.
Yeah. Why don't you tell people about the story about the kid who stole the library book? Because it fits in yeah. just so well.
Sure. Yeah. I like to use this as an example because this is pretty fitting as far as like the process for someone that doesn't know what goes on behind the scenes. And I can talk about that too within the story. But so for instance, like for restorative practices, we had a student that went into the school library for a book fair and grabbed a book, threw it under his jacket, and then walked out. Well, the librarian had seen him do that, and so she chased after him and brought him to the front office. Well, typically in a traditional model, that student would have just been sent to ISS for 3 days. And so with the restorative practices, though, I brought him and the librarian into the conference room, and we did a restorative circle. Now, I was quick on time. So typically in a restorative circle, what I would do is I take the student individually and talk with them. And that would be the ownership component. So the student is taking ownership of their action. Thankfully, I knew the student. So he took ownership with the librarian there. And we worked through like what's behind the behavior. Why is it that she took the book? Because I knew that, you know, if he called his mom and was like, hey, I want this book. And she confirmed this was that she would get the book for him. Well, it was because he wanted to show it for his friends. You know, it was like, I'm going to be cool in this moment. So he was like, watch this, shoved the book under his jacket and walked out. So he was remorseful. And was like, how many days of ISS do I have? Well, no, that's not what we're doing here. Let's figure out a plan to give you a consequence, but have it related to what you were doing. So I asked him as far as what is the consequence going to be? So after him doing some brainstorming, he decided that he was going to come in before school for 2 weeks, which was a lot longer duration than I would have assigned him, for 2 weeks for the entire rest of the book fair, because it had just started, and that he was going to volunteer his time before school to help out the librarian. So the librarian agreed to it. And he also said that he wanted to be like a secret shopper. So he would also look for other students to make sure that they didn't steal, which that was the big thing too, right? Was like, how can you help in this environment so it doesn't occur again, not only for yourself, but other people. So then he also took it upon himself to then devise, okay, I want to make sure that when students come in, all their backpacks go to the side and I'm going to direct them to do so. So not only was he going to be a secret shopper, but he was also going to be directing kids in hopes that stealing would go down. So then we also talked about who it affected, right? So his behavior obviously affected the library, but it also affected the librarian because the librarian is using the book fair for fundraising to enhance her educational environment. So that was the teach piece too of like all the ripple effect of his actions. And if a lot of students did it and saw based on what he modeled, then obviously she's losing funds. Great thing about it is that instead of going just to ISS, he apologized to the librarian. So he fixed that relationship, but he also restored the environment that he broke, which was from the stealing. He served his time, the 2 weeks. But the other thing that happened was that the relationship between him and the librarian grew so much that he actually would go before school and during lunch just to volunteer, to take the books and put them back where they belong. And that relationship between him and the librarian would have never existed. In fact, it probably would have been a lot of hostility between each other if I would have just put him in ISS for 3 days. And I think that's the breakdown between like your traditional models versus the restorative piece is a lot of times when they go into an ISS room, that's easier for them. It was really hard for the student to admit, I did something wrong. This is why I did it. This is who I harmed. And then what am I going to do and build that plan out to fix what I did? And so those are skills. Those are life skills that all of us need to possess. And if I just throw them into a room, that's not going to happen. And the other thing too is like, and this happens so often with teachers and students, is that they're away from each other. They're angry. They have, again, that hostility toward each other. And then we just throw them back together without any resolution whatsoever. There's no talking about what happened. And then it really just gets worse. And so these are communication skills. These are reflective skills. I mean, there's so many things that are like executive functioning pieces that need to occur that we just never give space to as administration, as teachers. And so, yes, it takes a little bit longer, obviously, for restorative practices to occur. But the benefit of that is immense. In fact, Charlie, just to give you some data, just to nerd out for a second, 99% of the students that went through a restorative circle or restorative practices in our campus never had a reoccurring event.
Wow.
So for instance, that student that stole something never had a referral for stealing for his whole rest of his educational career on our campus, right? Mm-hmm. So in middle school, you're with us for 3 years. So that was a year and a half where that student never stole anything again. So that's the thing that we were tracking a lot too, is like, not that the students were perfect, but as far as a reoccurring event that occurred, right? So maybe the student, you know, did steal some from the cafeteria once, had a restorative practice, that behavior stopped. Maybe they got in a fight later, but then they didn't have a fight after that. So like the idea is that our kids are going to make mistakes, but if we just put them in a space in ISS to just be away from everybody, and that's our only goal, well, they're not learning or growing in any way as far as being a person. And so that's why I'm so passionate about restorative practices. And I don't care what you call it. There's probably a lot of terms that you can use, but the main thing is that you're allowing the student to take ownership. They're rectifying what occurred and that they're learning the behaviors that need to occur if that experience happens again.
I mean, it's so like such an immersive experience for the kid, for that character building. I mean, how many times do we have schools that say, okay, this month I'm focusing on this character and this quality, right? And that's all good stuff. Like we need to keep doing that stuff perfectly. That's fine. But it's like, how can we do it and engage kids every day with this kind of thing to where it really is making an impact? And so it's the tough ones that we want to stop. I love that you share that data because it's the tough reoccurring behaviors that we often, it's harder to do, right? It's harder to address those. So we're really good at engaging the kids on a daily basis who are willing to accept it, but it's the ones who challenge us that's trickier. And so what I love about this is that because of your experience with it, we've developed this long-term solution where we get to develop teams to teach them how to do these things, but they don't have to go through all of these big trainings for all of the pieces. That's what I love about what you and I do, Josh, is we take all the pieces that we know and how do we implement it into everyday practice in a simplified way. So like, for example, when you're talking about that restorative practice, we may not have time. Like we, especially I know as a classroom teacher, I didn't have time for that stuff, but I did learn how to make effective statements and to model some of that so that we can talk about it. I did restorative circles, but as a, like a check-in and check-out we could do, but you could do that in very simplified ways. Like you don't have to do all of these big things all the time. That's what you and I are trying to do here. And so like, for example, when we model ways to express our feelings that helps our kids learn to name the feeling so that they can have awareness and then self-regulate. That's something I would do in clinical practice, of course, based on Dr. Dan Siegel's work, the Name It to Tame It. We know that neurologically that in itself is helpful and it doesn't take long. So you could say like, when you interrupted the lesson, I felt really frustrated because I was trying to help the class do better. So that interrupted that. And so oftentimes, like kids, they want to do well. Kids just kind of are impulsive more so than adults are because they don't have that developed brain. And so when we model that for them, there's just so much richness to it that I love. Or the restorative questions. We could ask restorative questions without having to do an entire process. We could just kind of guide that reflection and accountability with questions like, what were you thinking at the time? What were you thinking right before you made that decision? And I love this, Josh, because when I talk with kids in clinical sessions and I ask them that, they feel humanized. Like they say that, well, when you asked me that, I didn't realize it was a or something I did or thought beforehand. I didn't think that I could actually get control of it the next time. So and they're not saying this, you know, sixth graders exactly this eloquently, but they're saying it gave me time to stop and think about that. I could make a decision and can think about that first, especially with the kids I work with who are have ADHD, that impulsivity and that emotional dysregulation is very prevalent. So just little questions that we can insert into our daily practice does not have to be big for any leaders or any teachers who are listening. So, or who was affected by the decision you just made? Who was affected? And if you say it like that, it's not really accusatory. It's like, who, when you made the decision, what were you thinking right before that? Or who was it affecting, including you? Like, how did it affect you? And what do you think needs to happen to make things right again? So because oftentimes when we have these conversations too, Josh, you can see their face, like they don't want to do bad things. They don't want to do things that make them look quote unquote bad, because often those reoccurring incidents give them that reputation of being that kid. And they know it. All these kids know it. So what is like something that you can tell a leader to do to help their staff immediately without making it feel too big, Josh? What would you say?
Yeah. As far as the relationship action team that we've talked about before, like that is something that was building a team of like-minded folks that really wanted to dive into the work. And I think that's the biggest thing. If you try and do this campus-wide and a lot of people have preconceived ideas or biases, maybe they were on a campus before, they tried to roll this out and it failed miserably. Well, obviously they're going to attach that to the term. And so I would say start small. This is work that I did on two different campuses for almost a decade. And it's not easy because you're trying to rewire folks as far as what their perception of punishment and consequences are. And for me, like not only building a small team, but then also like changing the idea and the mindset of even small definitions and making sure we're all on the same page as far as our communication terms we were going to use, what they meant, so that we're on the same page. As far as restorative practices, you talked about like how it takes a little bit longer of a time and like teachers can't really do it. You know, you're in charge of potentially 30 kids in your classroom. So to pull a kid aside and or two students aside and do a sort of circle is probably not in the works. But for me, like, you know, as it was built out, I did have a restorative team that were trained and were able to facilitate that conversation with a student or with multiple students. And so I did lean on them because as an administrator, I tried it. I tried to do all of it myself and I couldn't. I dropped the ball constantly because I had so many restorative circles that I needed to get done in addition to all the other things I had to do as an assistant principal. So you do have to have other people to facilitate those for you and be trained. And so that's, you know, obviously Charlie, what you're talking about is us supporting schools is that's the layout that we have for you. That's the guide, that's the roadmap that folks, if you're interested, can take advantage of because you can't do it alone. You got to have a group of people and I can start out small, right? It was 7 people when we first started doing this work as a relationship action team. And by the time we were done that year, we had half the staff. It grew organically. We were seeing things that were working in the classrooms in the school that other people wanted to adopt and they were excited about it. And it was something new. And I think that's the biggest thing is trying to make a culture shift is gaining some steam, starting small, but over time, getting the understanding that people they want to have a good classroom. They want to teach kids the right way and they want kids to behave. And if we're just doing the same thing as we always have done, nothing's really going to change in that. So that's how we did it.
Yeah. And that is so important that whatever we've been doing, if that's not working, we got to just shift it. Like that's easy, right? And I will say as a teacher, there are definitely ways you can do this to teach these practices and have kids dive into it more when you can get pretty creative. So I used to give some of these topics as research topics. So we're still doing the scientific method and following research and having them do APA citations and all of that and annotated bibliographies and all this. So you can do it by having them like research the person who came up with behavior modification or who came up with this particular outcome or restorative practices and give, you know, what was their life like and what made them want to do that and what are some principles of that. Or you can just give them some guiding questions based on it, or you could do something like a social autopsy, like take this situation where something went wrong and then have them review the conflict and then identify alternative solutions. So there's a lot of ways that you can do that. And you're teaching them the process of some of these things that they can then be like, oh yeah, I can use this in my life. We did this a lot. My curriculum allowed for it, mind you. I got to teach a lot of different things like sociology, psychology, anthropology, mental illness. And so I got to teach about some therapeutic strategies this way. But you can do this in any class where they have to even collect data. You could do this in a math class, collect data, use this practice and see how many times your outcome is positive. Well, what's the criteria for making it positive? So now you're inserting critical thinking practice. So there's a lot of ways, I'm telling you, that you can get really creative. And actually in Thriving Educator Premium, the system that we use to train educators and leaders is to give some resources around this so you can just implement them easily. So we can kind of show you how to do that. But I'm telling you, you do not have to go all out with every single thing. Just learn how to ask questions better, learn how to model some of these things better, learn how to regulate yourself, reflect openly in front of kids, and just start so small and you just keep adding things on. Yeah.
Yeah. We used to do relationship circles to model the premise of a restorative circle. And so that way the students at least got kind of the process and procedure of it without understanding truly what we were doing, which was we were modeling what a restorative practice would be if they were to get into that situation. So we did it as a proactive piece with more like relationship building, fun things. But again, it was really just to model what they might see later on the other end if we had to be reactive. There's a lot of ways to do it. Charlie was 100% correct. Charlie, for those who may have more questions, we've made it very, very easy. And that we have a bit.ly for folks. So if you go to bit.ly/LOB questions, if something was spawned from this conversation or a prior episode, feel free to fill that out. And we love answering questions and really trying to get at what's going on in the classroom, campuses, or at districts, and what you're seeing right now as the end of the year is approaching us. So Charlie, I know that you have some wonderful resources for everyone at thrivingeducator.org. So I want to make sure that everyone heads over there. If you're looking for additional information about Charlie's services or just some free resources, and then over at my website for the same thing, joshtamber.com. And if you actually go to joshtamber.com/language of behavior, that's probably a better space where you're going to find more of our work. And I'll throw that up on the screen for those who are watching on YouTube. All right, Charlie, will you just give some ending words for episode 23?
Yeah, just keep this simple. Anytime you think of restorative practice, it's when someone has been harmed, including you, but when a relationship has been harmed, keep it really simple. Number one, how can you prevent and how can you repair? And prevention, because we're always about prevention, is instead of going through like a whole process, keep it simple just by getting a verbal agreement from them. Just say, you know, we can all agree that we're going to take 3 breaths before we react and we're angry. And then we can hold them accountable verbally for that later too. You know, and then repair, just ask the simple question, was what you just did helpful, or the choice you made helpful or harmful? And then what can we do next? Keep it all simple. That is truly the point.
Wonderful. All right, everyone. Hopefully you have a wonderful week and we will see you at the end of May, May 27th for the Thriving Educator webinar. And we'll make sure that we get that link to everyone soon. And with that, if you need anything, Charlie and I are here for you and would love to hear from you and how we can support you.
This podcast is a proud member of the Teach Better Podcast Network. Better today, better tomorrow. And the podcast to get you there. Explore more podcasts at www.teachbetterpodcastnetwork.com. We'll see you on the next episode.